Om sahana vavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahavidyan karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu mavitvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shah. Om namo brahmadibhyo. Om Brahmavidya Sampradaya Kartrabhyo Brahmavidya Vamsharshabhyo Mahadbhyo Vamsharshabhyo Namo Gurubhyaha Namo Narayanam Padmabhuvam Vasishtam Naray Padmabhuvam Shaktim Chatat Putra Parasharancha Shaktim Chatat Putra Para Vyasam Shukam Gauraparam Mahantam Vyasam Shukam Gauraparam Govinda Yogindra Matasya Shishyam Govinda Yogindra Matasya Shri Shankaracharya Mathasya Padma Shri Shankaracharya Mathasya Param Chahasta Malakam Chashishyam Param Chahasta Malakam Tam Totakam Vartika Karamanyan Tam Totaka Vartika Karamanyan Asmat Gurun Santatamanatosmi Asmat Gurun Santatam Namah Shri Shankarananda Namah Shri Shankarananda Guru Parambu Janmane Guru Param Savilasa Mahamoha Savilasa Maha Grahat grasaika karmane, grahat grasaika karmane. Very good. Nice to see you all this evening. Do you think from next week, can we chant this together, do you think? We'll try. That's the idea, that we should be chanting these introductory verses together. We'll see how you do. All right. So in our last class, we're in the midst of this wonderful part of Chapter 7, Tripti Deepa Prakarana of Panchadashi, this great text of Sri Vidyaranya Swami. And in the last class, he introduced the Dashama Purusha, Dashama Ten Purusha person, the tenth man story. And that tenth man story very nicely illustrated a point we want to return to today. And that is a progression from paroksha jnanam to aparoksha jnanam. First, what do these two terms mean? Paroksha jnanam, we use that term for indirect knowledge, as opposed to aparoksha jnanam, that which is not indirect is direct. Paroksha jnanam. Aparoksha jnanam, sorry. So, in the example of the 10th man story, When the 10 men were told, the one you're looking for is not dead, he is here now, they received knowledge. All 10 of them received knowledge, that same knowledge. What kind of knowledge was it that they received? We call that paroksha jnanam, indirect knowledge. Why? They didn't recognize themselves as the missing person. So notice this progression. First, they got paroksha jnanam, indirect knowledge. The one you're looking for is here now. They can even think about it in terms of general knowledge. For our Sanskrit students, it's called apatata jnanam, general knowledge. but we'll use the term paroksha jnanam here because it's more specific. As opposed to when the passerby told him, hey, you count the other nine, and you are the tenth. When the man was told, you are the tenth, his indirect knowledge, paroksha jnanam, was immediately transformed into direct knowledge. aparokshajnanam. And this is very significant, extremely significant for Vedantic students, because for almost everyone, means everyone, for all intents and purposes, everyone starts with parokshajnanam. We understand what the teachings of Vedanta say, but it's not aparoksha, at least not initially. So, we're going to return to this topic, by the way, in today's class and the next class. We're seeing a very elaborate unfoldment of this topic in the text, which is one of the things that makes this chapter so wonderful. So, in that tenth man story, we saw the progression from indirect knowledge to direct knowledge, and then the author, Vidyaranyaswami, took those two steps and expanded them into a series of seven steps. And let's remember what those seven steps are. We need to know that for today's class. So it started with ajnana, ignorance. I don't need to write the definitions because you saw the definitions last time. So the first step was ajnana, ignorance. Second step was avarana, which was covering. Avarana. Covering. Third was vikshepa, projecting. Fourth was parokshajnanam, which we've been talking about, the indirect knowledge. The fifth step, aparokshajnanam, direct knowledge. These should already be in your notes, but if not, they're worth getting down. The penultimate step we called shoka nivritti, shoka, sadness, nivritti, cessation. And the final step is the title of our chapter, tripti, contentment, fulfillment, used as a synonym here for moksha. So the tenth man story really brought out very clearly the progression from parokshajnana to aparokshajnana, and then in our last class we saw that expanded into these seven steps. And just to remind you very quickly before we return to our verses today, we start with ajnanam. In the case of the tenth men, non-recognition. In fact, to go back to Pujya Swami Dayananda's nice, really insightful definition, self non-recognition. Perfect. It's a particular kind of ignorance. That's good. We'll call it self non-recognition. That self non-recognition then is apparent in this twofold way. One is in avarana, covering. That which you seek is covered, obscured, veiled. So in the case of the tenth men, the one they were looking for was obscured by ignorance, veiled, hidden by ignorance. In the case of Vedanta, Satchidananda Atma, the truth of yourself, is veiled also by ignorance. We also observed, and nice to come back to, this is a subtle point. This veiling is partial. That is, the one you're seeking is partially known, partially unknown. Do you remember the metaphor I gave, why it's partial? We said, if you see that snake, I'm sorry, if you're going down the alley, and if it's pitch black, will you see a snake? You won't see anything if it's pitch black. So what happens is the rope is partially obscured. This is a very important point. You see that there's something there, but you can't make out that it's a rope. It is partially obscured. We could say that its existence is not obscured. Its nature is obscured. I'll say that again. With regard to the rope snake, we're explaining these two steps of avarana vikshepa. By the way, that's going to be the rest of our class. This is our topic for today. Very wonderful analysis of this avarana and vikshepa. So, returning to that rope snake, the existence of the rope. In Sanskrit, we call that astitva. Astitva means existence. The existence of the rope, you see. You see there's something there, but its nature, swarupa, is not known to you. You don't know it as a rope. So you see the idea of partially being veiled. In fact, I guess the term veil is quite appropriate. The veils that women wear in India are of a fabric that's very translucent. You can see through it, so that when they're veiled, they can see through the veil. So that's the idea of partial obscurement by means of that veil. In the same way, Atma is partially obscured, not fully obscured. If Atma is fully obscured, you wouldn't know you're conscious. You know you're conscious. Hey, that consciousness happens to be Atma. Oh, really? You know that you are conscious. That consciousness is Atma. So it is known to you partially. Its existence, the existence of consciousness, is very apparent to you. But its nature, swarupa, is obscured. So partially known, that you are conscious, is known to you. But the nature of that consciousness is not known to you. That's the partial obscurement, and that is the avarana. Then... Because of the partial obscurement comes the next step, projection. Because the rope is partially obscured, you're able to project a snake. Because Atma is partially obscured, you're able to project everything. I am this, I am that, I am a mother, father, husband, son, fill in the blanks, doctor, lawyer, I am, and including I am happy, I am sad, I am smart, I'm an idiot, any and all of this. These are all examples of vikshepa, all of which take place because of avarana, and we're going to come back to this in just a moment, so I won't talk further about that. Then, how is this all removed? First, through paroksha jnana, the indirect knowledge. The tenth man is told, the one you're looking for is here now. In the same way you hear, Atma is Satchitananda. You gain it first as information. Paroksha jnanam is information. Then, and we're going to see this, actually I think we're going to see this also in today's class, the paroksha jnanam gets converted into paroksha jnanam, direct knowledge. How that gets converted, we have to discuss. And then, with this direct knowledge that I'm not this body and mind, I'm not the idiot, sorry to use the word, I'm not the idiot I took myself to be, I'm in fact Satchitananda Atma, with that discovery, sadness and suffering goes away. In the absence of that shoka navritti, in the absence of sadness and suffering, you discover yourself to be tripta. Tripta is the adjective form. Full and complete. Tripti, completeness, fullness, contentment. Okay, that brings us back to our text. At the end of the last class, we had discussed, we're going now, the first part of our class is going to be a discussion about each one of these. Latter part of this class, if we get that far, I think we will, we'll focus on the first three. First part, we want to go through all seven of these. Ajnana, we saw in verse 29. We saw verse 29 in the last class. So we continue today with verse 30. Verse 30, we'll discuss both avarana and vikshepa, are both considered in verse 30. Nabhati nasti kutastha, nabhati nasti kutastha, iti vakti prasangataha, iti vakti prasangataha. Karta bhoktaham asmiti, karta bhoktaham asmi, vikshepam pratipadyate, vikshepam pratipadyate. Kutastaha. We've seen that word several times in this text. It's one of the author's favorite words. It literally means unchanging. And of course, we're talking about consciousness. That unchanging consciousness, which is your true nature. What about that unchanging consciousness that's your true nature? Well, vakti, it is said, prasangataha, in this context, iti, thus. How is it said? Na bhati, na asti. Na asti. Unchanging consciousness, nasti, is not. Unchanging consciousness, na bhati, does not appear, is not present in my experience. Now, we're talking about avarana. Right now, consciousness is present. Any doubt? We joked about that last time. Who among you, Aray Swamiji, I don't think I'm conscious. How can No one can say that. So, that you are conscious, there's no doubt, but let me ask you then, is your consciousness unchanging? And you say, Swamiji, nasti. Because you speak in Sanskrit, right? Na asti. Kutastaha na asti. My consciousness is not unchanging. Na bhati. That is not apparent in my experience. What is my experience? Consciousness goes on changing. Therefore, na asti. Unchanging consciousness does not exist. Na bhati, unchanging consciousness is not present in my experience. Why? These are the effects of avarana. Even though that consciousness is immediately present, it is partially obscured. Therefore, you know that you are conscious. You do not know the nature of your consciousness as kutastha, unchanging. So, vakti prasangataha. Prasangataha, due, another interpretation, due to connection, prasangataha, due to what kind of connection? Due to a connection with ajnana, due to the presence of ajnana, the true nature of consciousness is partially veiled. That is avarana. Then, since consciousness is veiled, then what happens as a result? Karta bhokta ham aham asmi iti. Step two, aham asmi, I am. What am I? Karta, I am an agent of action. Bhokta, I am the enjoyer of experiences. I am a thinking, feeling, human being engaged in all kinds of worldly activities. That's conventional thought. Yeah. By conventional thought, people suffer. We're not after some kind of conventional thought here. The truth of Vedanta is unconventional in the extreme. So here, the conventional way of understanding oneself as an karta, as an agent of action, as a bhokta, as an experiencer, is referred to here. These are vikshepam pratipadyate, vikshepa, projection. Pratipadyate is established how? I am the agent of action, I am an experiencer of various activities. Here we need to go back to our fundamental metaphor that we're using throughout here. We did this in our meditation last Sunday. So we'll return to this. Remember our bucket full of water? All right. So this we'll call kutastha chit. Unchanging consciousness. Kutastha chit is the light shining down on the bucket. What about the light reflected from the bucket? It's not kutastha. It's not unchanging. It's conditioned. It's conditioned by what? By the nature of the water and indirectly by the bucket. So the term we've been using, chidabhasa, is the reflected consciousness. So look what this verse is saying. The first says, due to avarana, one says, I am not kutastha. Who says? The experiencer. You, the experiencer. Remember we said the ego and the individual person, jiva, the one who is sitting in your chair is represented by its reflected light. But as we've observed many times, light is light. This light happens to be conditioned, but suppose this light weren't conditioned. As what happens in deep sleep, when the mind becomes perfectly quiet, in deep sleep, you find yourself to be at peace. Deep sleep is a contentment, is a stage of contentment. Tripti. What do you experience in deep sleep? Shoka nivritti and tripti. Why? Because in deep sleep, the distinction between kutastha chit and chidabhasa, the distinction goes away. Why? Because the mind is quiet. But in the waking state, because of ignorance, your true nature as kutastha is veiled. You know that you are chit. You know that you're consciousness. But the true nature of consciousness as kutastha is unchanging, is veiled. That's the avarana. And then second step comes the vikshepa. Just as when the rope is partially obscured, you project a snake. When your true nature as unchanging consciousness is obscured, you start projecting other things. Projecting what? Well, notice that the chidabhasa is conditioned by the water and the pot. Bucket, we'll call it. Remember that the bucket represents your body. Just in simplified terms, body and mind. Sthula and sukshma sharira, in technical terms, body and mind in simple terms. So watch what happens. Do we see that here or elsewhere? Yes. So what the commentator says is that because this consciousness is conditioned by the body and mind, the attributes of the body and mind get superimposed on consciousness. That sounds fancy. It's very simple. Look at this. Instead of saying, I am unchanging consciousness, can you imagine when you go to a party, you're introduced to somebody, and they say, my name is Ram, what is your, and you say, you're Ram, nice to meet you. I am unchanging consciousness. Ram is going to really wonder about you. You'll think you're attending too many classes at Ashwamedha Center. Well, that's the truth. Anyway, so failing to recognize your true nature as unchanging consciousness, when this is veiled due to this avarana aspect of ignorance, then comes the vikshepa, the projection. What kind of projection? Suppose this is a fat bucket. What does this one say? I am fat. If the light is reflected in a fat bucket, what will he or she say? I'm fat. If it's a skinny bucket, I'm skinny. If it's an old bucket, I'm old. Right? If it's a leaking bucket, you get the idea. And similarly, if the water is agitated, I am agitated. If the water is simple and pure, I am pure. If the water is polluted, I am polluted. You get the metaphor. So what's happening then is we, because kutastha chaitanya, kutastha chit, unchanging consciousness, because it's veiled, we project, and specifically, what are we projecting? We're projecting that the attributes of the body and mind belong to consciousness. They don't. The attributes of the bucket belong to the bucket. The attributes of the water belong to the water. In the same way, the age and defects of the body are a fact, but they belong to the body. The defects of my mind are a fact, but they belong to the mind. None of that belongs to consciousness. But due to avarana, followed by vikshepa, all of these qualities is not the best word here. Attributes, the attributes of the body and mind, in particular the defects of the body and mind, get superimposed. When we superimpose the good stuff of the body and mind, it doesn't cause any suffering. But when we superimpose the defects of the body and mind, we suffer greatly. All right. We'll come back to some of this in a couple more verses, so we'll continue. So in 30, we saw avarana and vikshepa. Now in 31, we see an analysis of paroksha jnanam and aparoksha jnanam. Asti kutastha hityadau, asti kutastha itya, paroksham veti vartaya, paroksham veti vartaya, paschat kutastha hevasmi, paschat kutastha heva, ityevam veti vicharataha, ityevam veti vicharataha. All right. So the first two quarters are describing paroksha jnanam, indirect knowledge. The last two quarters, direct knowledge, aparoksha jnanam. What is the indirect knowledge? Asti kutastaha iti ityadau. In statements like kutastaha asti, unchanging consciousness exists. That's a statement. Happens to be a statement of fact. It's a true statement. Iti, paroksham veti. Veti, one knows paroksham, indirectly. One gains indirect knowledge. What is the nature of that indirect knowledge? Unchanging consciousness exists. How do you know unchanging consciousness exists? Because this text says so. Because Swamiji says so, because other books and teachers you've heard said so. Well, when someone says something to you like that, what you gain is information. Vartaya. Varta, the most common translation of varta is news. This is not news exactly, information. So you get the information. What is the information? Unchanging consciousness exists. That's what we first learn from our scriptures and teachers. That is the paroksha jnanam. But then, does paroksha jnanam put an end to your suffering? Unchanging consciousness exists, but my consciousness is subject to suffering. So you can see that indirect knowledge, unchanging consciousness exists, does not put an end to suffering because it is indirect, it is remote. A good friend of mine had he loved to study Sanskrit grammar, and so he would use grammatical metaphors when we were discussing Vedanta, and he said there's a difference between third person knowledge and first person knowledge. Third person and first person are grammatical terms. Third person is he, she, or it. Second person is you. First person is I and we, right? Remember that? So, paroksha jnanam is third person knowledge. Refers to a he, she, or it. Wait a minute. Are you a he, a she, or an it? What word, this is a trick question, by the way, what pronoun do you use to refer to yourself? Do you refer to yourself as he, or she, or it? I bet you refer to yourself not by any of those three, you refer to yourself with the pronoun I, right? So that which is referred to by he, she, or it is necessarily remote, indirect. And this is the third person knowledge that my friend spoke about, as opposed to first person knowledge, which refers to I. So if something called Satchidananda Atma is kutastha, unchanging, what's in it for me? Sounds like there's nothing in it, which is why paroksha jnanam is not enough. That paroksha jnanam has to be converted to aparoksha jnanam, direct knowledge, which is discussed in the second half. Paschat, later, kutastha eva asmi iti. Kutastha eva, unchanging consciousness alone, asmi, I am. For our grammar students, notice the first half says kutastha asti, it is. Unchanging consciousness is, in the third person. In the second half, kutastha asmi, in the first person, I am. First half, kutastha is. Second half, kutastha is me. I am that kutastha. Iti evam veti. When veti, one knows, evam, thus. Thus meaning how? How in the form of I am. That kutastha, that unchanging consciousness. How does one come to understand that? How does paroksha jnanam get converted into aparoksha jnanam? Do you think that's an important topic? It's an extraordinarily important topic, which will be discussed in other places in this chapter and in other chapters of the 15 chapters of Panchadashi. But right now, we get a one-word explanation of how does indirect knowledge get converted into direct knowledge. Here, we just get that one word. What is that one word? Vicharataha. Due to inquiry. Vicharataha, due to inquiry. Now, we need to amplify this. Inquiry into what? If the newspaper gives you information, and you inquire further into the newspaper or into the story told by the newspaper, you're only going to get more information, right? So in the same way, when the scripture is talking about Satchidananda Atma being kutastha, when you inquire into the scripture more deeply, you're only going to get more indirect knowledge. So, if you want to convert indirect knowledge into direct knowledge, you should do the inquiry in the right place. What is the right place? Well, aparoksha jnanam is knowledge about I, me. So the vicharataha, the further level of inquiry, is a level of self-inquiry. We talk about shastra vichara and Atma Vichara. Shastra Vichara, inquiry into the meaning of the scriptures. Atma Vichara, inquiry into one's true nature. Using these teachings, of course. I'll just share with you what the commentator has to say about this. He says, very nicely, he says, hmm? page. This is verse 31. Oh, he says, how vicharataha means what? Or he says, when is it converted? He says, shravanadi paripaka vashat. Shravanadi paripaka vashat. He says it gets converted. Indirect knowledge gets converted into direct knowledge when? Paripaka vashat, when there is the maturation of what? Shravanadi. Shravana, etc. Shravana, manana, nididhyasana. So when shravana, manana, nididhyasana, when these three practices become paripaka, literally, well cooked, well done, well perfectly completed. When you have done an adequate amount of shravana, manana, nididhyasana, that indirect knowledge, paroksha jnanam, is converted into direct knowledge of paroksha jnanam. Shravana, manana, nididhyasana mean what? Shravana, in the definition we're using here, shravana is not mere study of the scriptures. That's a very common definition, and it's not a helpful definition, because we already discussed, if you delve deeply into the newspaper, you're only going to get more and more information. So shravana has to be properly understood, not as shastra vichara, not as inquiry into the scripture, but rather atma vichara, inquiry into oneself. Then why do you call it shravana? Shravana means that which you get by listening to the scriptures from the teacher. Why is it called shravana? It's a process, you've heard me use these words, a process of self-inquiry guided by the scriptures as unfolded by a teacher. That's one of the best definitions you get anywhere. Shravana is not shastra vichara. It's not mere inquiry into scriptures. It is, in fact, atma-vichara, self-inquiry. But that self-inquiry has to be guided. Suppose someone says, suppose you went and saw someone sitting in a cave, and you wanted this person to make you enlightened. And you say, oh, master, please teach me how to be enlightened. And he says, you have to inquire into your true nature. How? Ask yourself the question, who am I? And that's all he tells you. Who am I? Who am I? Who am I? Oh, who am I? I'm this body, I'm this mind, etc., etc. So you can undergo a process of self-inquiry, but if it's not properly guided, how is that going to be effective in accomplishing anything? So notice the definition. Shravana is not shastra vichara. It's not inquiry into scriptures. It is, in fact, atma vichara, inquiry into atma, into one's true nature, but the important qualification, atma vichara, self-inquiry guided by the scriptures. And a further qualification, because you are likely to misinterpret the scriptures. So the further qualification is the process of self-inquiry guided by the scriptures as taught by a qualified teacher. This is shravana. Then manana is another practice for removing doubts. In that process of self-inquiry guided by the scriptures, you're likely to have doubts. Those doubts need to be removed. By whom? That's why you need a teacher. That's another reason you need a guru. If you have a doubt, can you ask a scripture? Oh, Panchadashi, please answer my question. Well, Vidyaranya Swami died how many centuries ago? He said 14th century, I think. So 600 years ago already, he's no more. He's not around. Just a quick aside, you know, there are people who think, oh, maybe he is in some astral realm. And there are people, by the way, you know this, and just a quick aside, just for fun. It's a little heavy topic, so this will just allow you to relax for a minute. And something that Pooja Swamiji liked to talk about is there are people who take instructions from dead gurus. Lots of people. They take instruction from dead gurus. So Vidyaranya is a dead guru, so you can ask him. He's in some astral realm, so you can ask him a question. Pooja Swamiji observes, if you're enlightened, you don't get reborn into any realm, including not into an astral realm. So then who are these fellows, if there are anyone at all floating, or anyone, we don't know. Personally, I find it highly doubtful, but suppose, giving them the benefit of the doubt, suppose there are some kinds of beings in some kind of astral realm. Again, I don't think so, but suppose we give them the benefit of the doubt. Somebody is there, and you can somehow connect with them. Okay, so you connect with them. But tell me, if they're existing in an astral realm, doesn't that mean they're not enlightened? So whoever you're getting instruction from in that astral realm is not enlightened. What kind of guru is that? That's not the right one. Better to have an enlightened dead guru than a non-enlightened astral guru. Anyway, enough said. I've distracted myself completely now from the topic. Shravana Manana Nididhyasana. Look at this, I'm distracting myself. So, how do you convert indirect knowledge into direct knowledge? Shravana, manana, nididhyasana. So, manana, removing doubts. To remove doubts, you need a live teacher. And nididhyasana, contemplation. Contemplation is a big job. We're not going to talk about it further now. It's a matter of making one's mind abide in this knowledge, removing habitual, undesirable patterns of thinking, and creating a mind that is just saturated with these teachings, permanently abiding in these teachings. That's not our topic right now, but the commentator says that is the process by which indirect knowledge is converted into direct knowledge. He says, The author of the text simply says, vicharataha, due to inquiry. Due to proper self-inquiry, the commentator adds, due to proper performance of shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Okay. So, the prior verse talked about avarana and vikshepa, numbers 2 and 3. This verse discussed Paroksha Jnanam and Aparoksha Jnanam, numbers 4 and 5. The next verse discusses 6 and 7, Shoka Nivritti and Tripti. Karta Bhokte Tyeva Madi, Karta Bhokte Vet, Shoka Jatam Pramunchati, Shoka Jatam Pram Kritam Krityam Pra. Prapaniyam, kritam krityam prapaniyam, praptamityeva tushyati, praptamityeva tushyati. So the first half, shoka nivritti, the second half, tripti. Shoka nivritti is described how? Karta bhokta iti evam adi shoka jatam pramunchati. When Aparoksha Jnanam takes place, you know that you are Kutastha Chit, unchanging consciousness. What can unchanging consciousness do? Can it drive to this ashram and attend this class? Who drove to this ashram to attend this class? You did, the one who's sitting in your chair. But what is the essence of the person sitting in your chair? Kutastha. The one who came here to class is the jiva, who's subject to suffering. But the essence of who you are is this unchanging consciousness. When you get it, that you are this unchanging consciousness and not this chittabhasa, then you come to discover that the problems of the body belong to your body, the problems of your mind belong to your mind, and what belongs to kutastha chit? Nothing. It's just consciousness. In fact, just consciousness means no limitations, no problems. So that's why he says here, karta bhokta iti evam adi shoka jatam pramunchati. Pramunchati, one is freed because of this aproksha jnanam, this direct knowledge, one becomes freed of what? Shoka jatam. All of the causes for shoka, sorrow, suffering. And what are the causes of sorrow? He says, karta bhokta iti. And the word that didn't fit is asmi. It didn't fit in the verse, so he didn't include it. I am the agent of action. I am the one affected by experience. Karta means agent of action. Bhokta literally means experiencer, but we would amplify that and say one who is affected by experience. Who is the karta and bhokta? Who drove here today? Jiva. Who is listening to this class? Bhokta. Jiva. But suppose, and who has problems? The one who's sitting in your chair is the one with the problems. Suppose you get it that the problems belong to the body that's sitting in your chair and the mind contained therein, but those problems do not belong to you because you are kutastha chaitanya. This is shokanavritti. The backing up, remember, the projection that I am karta, the words in the verse, karta and bhokta. Karta, agent of action. Bhokta, the one who is affected by experience. That projection took place up here in step 3. Here in step 6, that projection comes to an end. The suffering arises due to vikshepa, not due to avarana. Veiling doesn't cause any problem. Not seeing the rope doesn't cause you any problem. Not recognizing Satchidananda Atma does not in itself cause a problem. What causes a problem is the projection. So if the problem is caused by the projection of being a karta and bhokta, agent and enjoyer, then the solution to the problem is when you get it that you are not a karta, you are not a bhokta, and the result of that knowledge is shokanivritti, the cessation of suffering. Suffering that's due to projection goes away when the projection is destroyed. That's the first half of the verse. Shoka jatam pramunchati. He is freed from shoka jatam, all the sources of shoka, which are in a form of being karta, agent of action, and bhokta, enjoyer. And then we come to the final step, tripti. And it's expressed here in just wonderful language. Kritam, kritam, krityam. Kritam, this is actually a common expression as a compound. Krita, kritya. Putting those two words together is quite common. Krita, kritya is a common expression, and here they're just broken apart in two parts. Kritam is what needs to be done. I've joked about this before. Do any of you keep a to-do list? You have a to-do list. Most people have. If not written down, it's up here. And be a nice experiment. Imagine a to-do list for your entire life. How long would that be? Long. Imagine seeing the list with every last item ticked off. A list, your to-do list for this entire life, and everything is ticked off. How would you feel? Oh, gosh, how good. This is tripti, contentment. Now, you're thinking, wait a minute, how can all those things possibly get ticked off? Ticked off, is that the right and the right and the wrong? My English is not very good, sorry. Crossed off, there we go. So how do you cross off all the items on your to-do list? It's a trick. You realize that the one who owns the to-do list, body and mind, not you. The one sitting in your chair may have a to-do list, but the pure consciousness, the unchanging consciousness, which is your essence, has no to-do list. Notice that to-do list implies these are things that need to be done for your welfare. That's the idea of it, right? Whatever needs to be done for your benefit, for your welfare, and you in a larger sense, including family, etc. And there are many, many things that need to be done for the welfare of our body and minds. What do you need to do for taking care of kutastha chit? You don't need to do anything. That's the sense. Kritam krityam. Everything that needs to be done is done. That krityam, that which is krityam. Krityam means to be done. Kritam means done. Kritam krityam. All that needs to be done is done. All that is krityam, to be done on your list, it is kritam. It is done. Not only that, but prapaniyam praptam. Parallel expression. Prapaniyam. That which needs to be acquired, attained, reached. Prapaniyam. Many things that need to be acquired or attained in life for the sake of one's welfare. For the sake of whose welfare? Body and mind. So when you recognize that all these things are prapaniyam, to be obtained for the sake of the body and mind, not for the sake of consciousness, therefore you get it, that prapaniyam praptam. Praptam means acquired. Prapaniyam praptam, that which is to be acquired, is already acquired. Which means what? What do you need to do for the sake of your own contentment? Nothing. Kritam krityam, all that is to be done is done. Prapaniyam praptam, all that is to be acquired is acquired. Therefore, what remains? Eva tushyati. In that manner, one is tushyati, one is content, one is pleased, tripti. This is contentment. Contentment is this condition that nothing needs to be done or acquired for the sake of your welfare. Everything is absolutely okay as it is. This is contentment. Of course, this is all predicated on what? On the discovery that you are this unchanging consciousness which is utterly unaffected by whatever is happening in your body and mind. That's the central discovery. Okay, so in these three verses, we saw a analysis of all seven of these stages. Actually, the first of these seven stages was discussed in last week's class. Now we have two more verses I think we'll be able to see tonight. The next two verses, we skip a couple, and then we continue with verses 36 and 37. We're going to see a more detailed analysis of these first three. So first, in the next two verses, we're going to see a detailed analysis of 1, 2, 3. And then when we meet next week, we'll see a further analysis of 4 through 7. Very detailed analysis. We'll get some new insights here as we proceed. So we'll continue. Amarge navicharyata amargena vicharyata nasti no bhati chetyasau nasti no bhati chet viparita vyavahritir viparita vyavahritir. There's a typo here, not avritehi, but avritehi. Avrite karyamishyate, avrite karyamishyate. Oh, this is interesting. Amargena vicharya ata na asti na ubhati chet asau. See the second line, asau, that. That what? That kutastha, that unchanging consciousness. What about that unchanging consciousness? What did we discuss? Due to ignorance and the presence of avarana, you say, na asti. That unchanging consciousness doesn't exist. Na bhati. It is not present in my experience. It doesn't exist. It is not experienced. This is the avarana. Why does that take place? Now we're getting some further information here. How does that take place? He says, vicharya, having inquired, doesn't everyone sort of think about, everyone thinks about what is, who am I and where am I going in this life? Everyone thinks about it, but most people, having entered into that kind of self-inquiry, they don't come up with the teachings of the ancient rishis. They come up with very different things. And that's what he says. Vidyaranya Swami says, amargena vicharya. Having inquired, vicharya, having inquired how? Amargena, incorrectly. Marga means path. Amarga means the wrong path. Having inquired by the wrong path. We've been discussing the right path. What is the right path? That which is, well, what we've been discussing here. We'll let a nice commentary here. Where are we? That's on 36. Yeah, here. So it says, Shastroktam prakaram atilangya. What is the wrong path? He says, ignoring what the scriptures say, shastroktam prakaram, the way that the shastras describe, atilangya, ignoring that, kevalam tarkena vicharya, and inquiring purely with the help of logic. This is what the commentator says. Inquiring purely with the help of logic. This is really the doctrine that we call materialism. So in the verse, he says, amargena vicharya, having inquired incorrectly. And what is that incorrect inquiry? According to the commentator, it's an inquiry that ignores the scriptures and relies purely on logic. And that's exactly what the common doctrine of materialism does. Materialism is a doctrine of philosophy. It's present in some scientists are materialists. And what they will say is consciousness is a product of your brain. Ask them if they can prove that. So with all of our modern technology, they can't prove it, but they say that. Based on what? Based on their doctrine of materialism. Materialism means everything comes from matter. And based on whatever reasoning, whatever tarka they exert, they use. Now let's be very clear about this. Let's take a moment to talk about this, because in modern times, this is a huge purva paksha, a big opposing point of view. In ancient times, it's interesting. This doctrine, we call it medical materialism, is a fancy name for it. Medical materialism is a doctrine that says what you Vedantins call is consciousness, they say it's merely a product of the brain activity. This is a doctrine known as medical materialism. if you look into our scriptures to see where this particular objection is taken up for discussion, you'll find it's not. Because in ancient times, they couldn't even conceive of consciousness being the product of brain. In fact, in ancient times, they didn't understand really what the brain did. I think, if I remember right, the ancient Greeks thought the brain was a radiator. Radiator means for the sake of cooling the blood. And it's partially true. The blood goes up into the brain, and if you don't wear a hat, you get cooled off. If you wear a hat, you get warmed up. So they're partially right. The brain does, in some manner, function as like the radiator in your car. They didn't understand its further uses. In fact, you'll be surprised by this. The connection between brain and thought. We take it for granted, right? Thoughts and brains are intimately connected. Thoughts and emotions are intimately connected. Brain and perceptions intimately connected. Brain and emotions intimately connected. We take that for granted, but did you know that the scientists figured that out only 150 years ago? That's how recent that knowledge is. 150 years ago, I'll just tell you the quick story, is a famous story of Phineas Gage. Did you ever hear his name? Phineas Gage was a railroad worker, and he was planting some dynamite. They were blowing up a cliff to put in the railroad, and they had a hole drilled. He put some dynamite in the hole. He had a metal rod. He was tamping that dynamite to get it ready for detonation. It detonated, and it fired that metal rod right through his skull. Amazingly, he didn't die. I mean, you'd think he would die. He didn't die. They managed to extract that bar from his head. Somehow he recovered, but everyone who knew Phineas Gage said, that's not Phineas. His personality had changed dramatically. Now, that's so obvious to us in modern times. This story is just 150 years old. He lived about 150 years ago. That's when we first began to see the connection between brain and behavior. Brain and what we call mind. Now, let's be very clear. What is the Vedantic position on this? And just to set up this argument, we're going to take this Purvapaksha for a few minutes, this opposing point of view, medical materialism, because it's a crucial argument in modern times. And before we see how we respond to this, let's be very clear. If Vedanta takes a position which is in opposition to science, who's going to win in the long run? What do you think? Consider the fact that the Roman Catholic Church, back in 400 years ago, took a position opposed to science. The Roman Catholic Church said that the sun goes around the earth. And they were firm. We said, we have thought about it, and we are declaring this is the truth. The sun goes around the earth. So that here, religion takes a position in opposition to science. Who wins out? Or in more modern times, other religious people say, how could human beings have evolved from apes? We are created in the image of God, using biblical language. So when they take that position, who's going to win out in the long run? Science will prevail if religion or philosophy takes a position contrary to science. Let's be very clear. Science will prevail in the long run. Maybe in a short run, you can make some religious and philosophical arguments. In the long run, science is so practical, you can't argue it. So, why am I saying this? If Vedanta were to take a position contrary to science, you have to give up. For example, In Vedanta, we often talk about five elements. Notice, I've never said that only five elements exist. Why? Like all of you, when we were students, we were told that there are over 100 elements. We know that. We reconcile the two. We say that, okay, this is a pre-scientific worldview. But suppose we were to hold on to it. No. There are only five elements. How ridiculous would that be? And then you say, but Swamiji, this chemistry book says there's 108, 116, I don't know. They keep inventing new elements or finding new elements. What should I say? Your chemistry books are wrong. By the way, you do know there are people who say that our biology books are wrong and science books are, and the ones that talk about Darwinian evolution, they'll say those books are wrong. Ridiculous. Okay. If Vedanta says something contrary to science, Vedanta will be proved wrong in the long run. However, we have no problem at all in agreeing with science. What does science say? Science says that everything that happens in your mind is a result of your brain. And we have no quarrel with that. Everything that happens in your mind is a result of the activity in the billions and billions of neurons in your brain. If Vedanta disagrees with that, Vedanta will be proven wrong. Mental activity can be definitely traced to the activity of the neurons in your brain. There's no need to disagree with that. Vedanta can agree with that completely. And there's no problem there. The problem comes when we talk about the knownness of those mental activities. Scientists can correctly demonstrate that mental activities are the result of specific activities in the neurons of the brain. And the science, neuroscience, are becoming more and more sophisticated all the time. In several more decades, they will have the brain exquisitely mapped. They will show this area does this, this area. They have it partially mapped right now. One difficulty, of course, is that every brain is different. And so they're going to have to come up with some way of giving you a unique map to your brain. How they'll do that, I have no idea. But in 100 years, they'll have it all figured out. It's not going to help us, but anyway, here's the point. Science will continue to refine its explanation of the relationship between specific mental activities and activities in the neurons of the brain that will absolutely be all mapped out. But here's where the difference comes. If you ask the scientists, who knows those mental activities? Who is the knower of those mental activities? The scientists are in trouble. They have a number of theories, but they have one fundamental problem, and that is, science measures stuff, right? In fact, they literally measure some of this research is done by putting electric probes into a living person's brain and making measurements. They are measuring the neuronal activity that causes neuronic, I think, different meaning. The activity of the neurons, it would be safer like that, they can measure that. They can measure the activity that gives rise to your thoughts. Can they measure the one who knows thoughts? Notice in Vedanta, we make this fundamental distinction between knower and known. The known is what? The entire universe, including your brain, including its billions of neurons, including the thoughts and emotions that arise in your brain, science can actually measure, and they will do so with increasing cleverness. They'll be able to measure their thoughts. In 100 years from now, they will plug something in that can read your thoughts. Absolutely. 100 years is a long time. It's that complicated. It's not a matter of decades. It's a matter of a century. But they will be able to read your thoughts electrically 100 years from now. But what are they measuring? The world. The realm of objects. Science is limited to the realm of objects, that which can be observed, that which can be measured. What is Vedanta concerned with? The world of objects or the conscious observer of those objects? So we begin by defining consciousness as being something other than the world of objects. That's our definition of consciousness. Consciousness is that by which mental activities are known. Mental activities are part of your brain. Fine, we can concede that, we can agree with the scientists all the way. But when we define consciousness as the knower of thoughts, we're putting consciousness in the category outside of the realm of observable objects, the world, and that which is outside of the world of observable objects cannot be studied by science. Science can only study stuff. Science can only study the observable world. Science cannot study the observer. So what I'm trying to establish here in brief is to give you a brief response to this modern argument based on medical materialism that says consciousness is a product of your brain activity. Scientists they have some theories about how it occurs, but theories that are unprovable. Unprovable why? They can't measure. They can only measure the activity of your brain. They can only measure things that arise as thoughts, emotions, and perceptions. They have no access to the observer, that which we call consciousness, chit. So the reason I'm dwelling on this a little bit is as I'm amplifying what the commentator says here, amargena vicharya. Having inquired incorrectly, having performed an incorrect inquiry into your true nature, and what is that incorrect inquiry? As you said, ignoring the scriptures and using pure logic, which is what science does. Science doesn't follow the teachings of Vedanta. Science uses just pure logic. But if that's how we inquire, we will come up with what conclusion? He says very nicely, na asti na ubhati, kutastha chaitanya, unchanging consciousness does not exist. Unchanging consciousness does not occur in experience. This is a conclusion for one who, vicharya, has done this inquiry, amargena, following an incorrect methodology, for example, following medical materialism. On the other hand, where am I here? And so this is the result of avarana. It is obscured. The nature of consciousness is obscured to science. Why? Let me say that again. You can stay with me just for a couple of minutes. This is a little challenging, I know. The nature of consciousness is obscured to science. This verse talks about avarana and vikshepa. So we're dealing with avarana again. The nature of consciousness is obscured to modern science. Why? Modern science can only measure objects. modern science cannot measure the subject, the knower. Science is concerned with the knowable world. Science has no access to the knower. So therefore, this avarana exists. And finally, viparita vyavahritihi avritehe karyam ishyate. This is the final thing that's taught in this verse. First part says that this avarana, due to incorrect inquiry, leads to the conclusion that this unchanging consciousness doesn't exist. You got that part, right? So avarana, because unchanging consciousness is obscured, one doesn't recognize it at all. It is obscured. Then what happens? He says, viparita vyavahritihi. Viparita, opposed, opposite, vyavahritihi, speaking, thinking, behavior, all of those meanings. So we'll just generally translate it as conclusions. Conclusions to the opposite, conclusions which are the opposite of unchanging consciousness. So conclusions to the opposite would mean changing consciousness. These conclusions are what? Avritehe karyam ishyate. There's making a connection between these two. Avarana is the cause. Vikshepa is the effect. He says, avritehe karyam. Karyam means effect. The effect of what? Avritehe, of avritti. Avritti is a synonym for avarana. So he's making a cause-effect relationship here. Because the nature of consciousness is obscured, therefore, the result is projection. We've been talking about this in other terms. He's just making it very clear. Because the rope is partially obscured, the result, the effect of the obscurement of the rope is a snake. A snake is born. How? Because the rope is obscured. You follow the language? The snake is born not from an egg. Snakes are born from eggs, I think, right? Yeah. So this snake is not born from an egg. This snake is born from what? From the rope being obscured. In the same way, taking yourself as your body and mind is born of what? It's born of the fact that the nature of consciousness is obscured. The obscurement of the nature of consciousness is the cause. What is the effect? Vikshepa. I am this, I am that, extending to I am an idiot. And all of the self-recrimination, bad feelings, and etc. that go along with that, all of that is the effect. So this is the important point being made in this particular verse. That is, avarana and vikshepa have a relationship. Avarana is the cause, vikshepa is the effect. Okay, this is a good place to wrap up for tonight. We'll continue next week. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om. Good. I forgot our short prayers at the altar. We'll let it be for tonight. Good night.